Adventist World Radio, from broadcast to baptism, powered by SID Media.
Hi, Lwazi, how are you?
Hi, Azama, how are you?
Sorry. Very well, thank you. How are you doing?
I thought you were speaking to somebody else. You spoke about Lwazi, so I thought you were speaking to somebody else.
Oh, okay. I see here it's written Cindy, so Lwazi Sibanda. I'm not sure if it's not your name.
Interestingly enough, Lwazi is my wife.
Oh, so, oh, okay, interesting.
I wonder how it's written, Cindy Solwazi, but it should be written just my name.
Ah, I get you. Good though.
I'm very well. I'm blessed and highly favored in religion. And yourself?
Oh, blessed indeed, man. Blessed indeed. I love the sound of that indeed.
Yeah.
Now, we're going to be talking about the non compete and no poaching agreements. Now, with competition authorities worldwide scrutinizing the labor market, non-compete and no poaching agreements between employers and employees have been receiving more and more attention. And today we want to learn about the components of no-compete and no poaching agreements and conditions of their enforcement. Now, firstly, what is a non-compete agreement and a no-poaching agreement? Talking about this, it was the first time I actually saw this preparing for this conversation.
Interesting. Thank you, Zama. Zama, a non-compete agreement, locally in South Africa, we call them restraints of trade.
Ah, that's right. A restraint of trade. Okay, all right.
Yes. Mm. Non-compete is generally, I think it's generally used in the United States. That's the term that they use. But mm-hmm. locally, we call them restraints of trade.
Trade, yeah.
Now, a restraint of trade is an agreement that limits your freedoms to do business, trade, or carry on your duty in your profession. I'll give you an example.
As the word says, it restrains you. Mm.
Exactly. So, for instance, an employee enters into an employment contract, and in the employment contract, she agrees to a term in the agreement that says that she cannot compete against her employer after she or he has left the employment, the employment relationship.
Mm.
Or a partner enters into an agreement with the rest of the partners in a partnership that should they leave the partnership, they are not going to open a business that competes with that particular partnership. Or a seller of a business may enter into an agreement with the purchaser of that particular business to say that they are not going to sell similar products to that those which are sold by the seller.
Mm-hmm.
So that is the non-compete, or what you would call the restraint of trade agreement.
Mm-hmm.
And then we've got non-poaching agreements. Now, non-poaching agreements are agreements that are made between two companies. And basically what they do is they restrain the certain key employees from being employed by their competitors.
Mm-hmm.
So basically the companies enter into an agreement that they are not going to employ for a certain period any employee coming from a particular company. For instance, myself and Zama agree that Zama cannot employ any of my employees simply because I need to protect certain trade secrets, intellectual property, or
mm-hmm.
the technical know-how of my company, and Zama as well wants to protect that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But this is beautiful, man. I'm sure we're going to be talking about these, in fact, let me just ask this question now in case, because I cannot find where I put my pen. So with these restraints, I was having my pen here so that I could actually make some notes as you go along. So,
I think maybe what you would want to know, Zama, would be what makes these restraints of trade or non-compete agreements valid and enforceable? I think that is possibly what you would want to know.
I would want to know that. But before we get there, the restraint of trade would generally have, I don't think it's enforceable forever. It should have some kind of cooling period. Are they involved in these cooling periods?
That is correct. That is correct, Zama. In fact, as we unpack this, I will take you to a particular case or particular cases when we unpack the whether they are valid or invalid. Right now, what happens is they cap or they limit the validity of the restraint. So
I
you
see.
cannot restrict somebody from
Indefinitely.
exercising their profession indefinitely. So there is definitely a limit.
Okay.
Now,
Right. Now, let's go to the next question. Yeah. What would make it this agreement valid and enforceable?
all right. So in our local sphere, restraint of trade agreements are valid and enforceable unless the terms of that particular agreement are unreasonable or contrary to public policy. Right. Now, public policy in itself dictates that all agreements that are entered into freely and voluntarily must be honored. This is the principle, a legal principle of, in Latin terms, we call it the pacta sunt servanda.
Right.
Right. It says that all agreements that are entered into freely and voluntarily must be honored, and that is a contractual principle. Right. I'll take you to a case, Zama, the case, a landmark case of Magna Alloy in relation to restraints of trade. Magna Alloys and Research Limited versus Ellis. Here it was held that a restraint of trade in itself is not prima facie unenforceable or invalid. And that every restraint of trade agreement that is signed by an employee is assumed to be lawful and enforceable. Now, the onus is on the employee to prove that the undertaking that they signed is contrary to public policy. So that is the employee's onus to prove if they want to be released from the restraint. They must prove that it is contrary to public policy and therefore cannot be enforced. The only exception is that a restraint of trade will be unenforceable, obviously, if it is contrary to public policy. Otherwise, generally, they are enforceable. Now, there is another case of Reddy versus Siemens Telecommunications. In this case, it was found that it is unreasonable. The restraint is unreasonable if it prevents a party after the termination of his employment from partaking in a trade or commerce without corresponding interests that are deserving of a protection. In other words, there must be a corresponding interest that the employer seeks to protect, which is deserving of that particular protection. An unreasonable restraint of trade is probably one that would prevent a party from engaging in trade and commerce indefinitely, for instance. That, as you were alluding to earlier. And there is no corresponding or deserve or it is the interest is not so it's not so huge as to deserve a particular protection by the law.
Okay. Now, these agreements, are they anti-competitive and unfairly restrictive to employees? What's the impact on the employers and employees? I'm now talking about the no poaching agreements.
Okay, great, great. Now, in South Africa, There are currently no express provisions in the South African Competition Act which specifically prohibit non-compete or non-poaching agreements between employers, right? However, from the face of it, the non-poaching agreements in themselves are naturally anti-competitive. In that they restrict competition amongst businesses. So, however, businesses are very creative in that what they basically do is they would enter into agreements that fix salaries and wages or benefits and terms and conditions of employees so that the employees don't move from one employer to another. However, this is actually contrary to public policy in itself, and it may be considered in terms of the Competition Act as price fixing. And anyone who is found to be engaged in any price fixing in terms of the Competition Act may be liable to hefty penalties, hefty administrative penalties, or reputational damage. And if they're involved, for instance, you've heard about the bread cartel, those were fined because they fixed the prices of bread. They also face potential criminal liability for the directors and the senior management. Right. On the other hand, it is quite arguable whether non-compete agreements are unfairly restrictive to employees. The courts will basically determine whether the agreements are unreasonable and contrary to public policy. That is the first thing that the courts need to determine. The test, Zama, to determine the reasonableness of a restraint of trade agreement was set out in Basson versus Chilwa.
Okay.
This is a 1993 case. And basically what it says is that when you're looking at whether it is the restraint of trade is reasonable or unreasonable, you are required to make an assessment of a couple of factors. Now, there are a few questions that you need to ask yourself. One, is there an interest of the one party which is deserving of protection at the termination of the employer-employee relationship or at the termination of an agreement? Is that interest being prejudiced by the other party? If so, does the interest weigh up qualitatively or quantitatively against the interest of the latter party, and the latter party should not be economically inactive and unproductive for extended periods of time? Is there another facet of public policy having nothing to do with the relationship between the parties, but which requires that the restraint should either be maintained or rejected? So that is what the courts generally look at. And the impact of these agreements on employees is that their ability to work for competitors is limited, while the employer can maintain a competitive advantage and prevent the spread of proprietary information. Now, there's a case of in Sudan and another versus workforce staffing. In this case, this was an appeal case in the Labor Appeal Court, and it found that a two-year restraint of trade, which prevented the appellant from taking up employment with respondents' competitors anywhere in South Africa, was unreasonable and contrary to public policy. On the other hand, in Beetle versus Slowjaw Innovation Hub, the courts found differently. The employee was appointed in this case as the head of research and development and possessed a specific knowledge of the company's operations in the beverage industry. The company, in their argument, they led evidence that established that a two-year period of restraint was justifiable. In this case, what they said is, once approached by a particular company to develop a soft drink for them, it takes them a period of up to 24 or 36 months before they conceptualize the product.
I see.
So now, because it takes them that long to conceptualize the product, they felt that it was justified to basically restrain the employee for a period of 24 months. And the labor court actually agreed with that, and it upheld the two-year restraint.
No,
because of that particular interest.
Yes, yes. You know, Cindy, so this is well and good, man. But who then takes care of, the employees' costs in the meantime? Because remember, this employee, by leaving this employment and having to join another employment, surely they've got to leave during that period. So who takes care of that during the restraints of trade?
That is correct, Zama. Look, I mean, we're not talking about unskilled people. If you look at the plethora of cases,
yeah,
especially in line with restraints of trade,
mm-hmm,
you will realize that these are skilled individuals. These are researchers. These are PhD holders. And they definitely have other avenues of, exploiting their skills.
I see.
They're not limited to those particular companies in this case.
I wonder though, because that may as well be the case. And granted, I mean, we'll grant that. However, during that period, there is a loss of income that would happen. So the transition period and other avenues where they would explore their income, of course, drops them. Or are you then saying this is at the unfortunate risk of the employee?
Look. There's a contract that is entered into, and that contract is valid. Mm. And they enter into that particular contract, freely and voluntarily.
I see.
And when you've entered into a contract freely and voluntarily, you basically need to shoulder the risks in the event that the relationship is terminated.
Mm. Mm.
And that is unfortunately the risk that they have to take, unless of course they can prove that the restraint is contrary to public policy. Then they can enter into an employment with the next employer.
So if the employer actually terminates the employment, so it is now the employer's doing by terminating the the contract for whatever reason, will they still, have the latitude to, enforce the restraint of trade?
That is correct, Zama. They can still enforce the restraint. They can still enforce the restraint because there is a legally binding contract that they've entered into. So this contract is binding regardless of who terminated the relationship, the employer-employment relationship.
Ah, I get you. Well, very interesting, Cindy Sosibanda. Thank you so much for your time, and always, always a pleasure talking to you. Beautiful insights you've given us this afternoon. Please do have a fantastic afternoon.
Thank you so much, Zaba, and thank you to your listeners.
Lovely, thank you.
Adventist World Radio, from broadcast to baptism, powered by SID Media.